Would you like to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a regular, monthly, tax-deductible gift? We've made it easy for you to donate using automatic withdrawal. Simply fill out and mail the automatic billing authorization form under the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. No more writing monthly checks or making monthly PayPal contributions. Issuesetc.org. Click donate and fill out and mail the automatic withdrawal form. Thanks for your support.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the next half hour or so of the program, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ergun Kaner, a former Sunni Muslim. We're going to be talking about the various kinds of Islam out there, usually sects, S-E-C-T-S. There are sects in Christianity, and there are also in Islam, this other great world religion. So what's the difference from one Muslim to another? Is there a sect of Islam that is more prone to the kind of violence, perhaps even world domination, that we've seen recently? Dr. Ergun Kaner is a former Sunni Muslim. He's president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary and Graduate School in Lynchburg, Virginia. And he's author of several books, including Unveiling Islam, An Insider's Look at Muslim Beliefs and Practices. Dr. Kaner, welcome back.
It's an honor, Todd. Thank you.
Is it important to understand the differences between the different kinds of Islam out there?
Oh, I'd say it's more than important. I'd say it's essential, especially in our culture, because the Muslims who seem to hold sway in the media, the ones who are most apt to take to the microphones, are the more moderate Muslims. And they, you know, of course, immediately scream that the type of Islam we're seeing actually on the news is not true Islam. And so it's almost a culture war right in front of us.
Well, let's talk about that question. If it were merely a matter of majority, that is, what one Muslim believes versus another Muslim, if it was merely a matter of majority beliefs, how would you characterize Islam? What would the beliefs be?
Oh, 81%. According to their own polls, 81% of Muslims worldwide believe in jihad as active warfare. What we see taking place, England, Germany, of course, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. We are seeing the honest, you know, the devout, if we can call them this, the orthodox Muslims. Jihad, you know, Islam has rarely changed in 1,300 years. Even the Muslims who consider themselves moderates, who don't believe in jihad, they respect the leaders who do, and that, you know, they always find themselves loath to say anything against the leaders who speak of jihad and teach on jihad.
Since you are a former Sunni Muslim, let's start there. And I understand that Sunni is also the majority belief in Islam. Mm-hmm. How would you describe it?
Well, Sunni Islam is easily 90% of the worldwide Muslim populace. It is, of course, diverse within that. I have ongoing debates with Muslims who are from different subsects of Islam, and they will say, "Well, we have never done this, or we don't face this direction, or you know, our Ramadan is only 30 days, etc." And I quickly add that you know, Sunni Islam is like, as you said, you know, it's as divided as Christianity is, in that they have four major schools, if you will, sects. But from those four major schools, there are myriad of different denominations, if you will.
So historically, what sets Sunni apart from, say, Shia or Sufism or any of the other sects?
Yeah, that's a good question. Muhammad dies without leaving directions as to who will take over. And it basically divides into two camps. One camp says that the leader of Islam must be a blood relative. Well, he didn't have any sons who lived past adolescence. So we're left with his daughter, Fatima, who marries Ali. And their child, of course, will be a blood child of Muhammad, the grandchild of Muhammad. And because they are the party of Ali, Shiite. But the others believe that it should be Muhammad's best friend, his father-in-law, whose name is Abu Bakr. And they hold sway, you know, and it becomes Abu Bakr as the first caliph after Muhammad's death. They are followers of the way. Sunnah is the way, and so Sunni becomes the division. the groups that they would consider aberrant or they would consider cults are Sufi, Alawite, you know, Druze. These are forms of Islam that still exist, and they are still Muslim, but they are not considered a mainline Muslim.
So Islam is literally divided from the very beginning, at least beginning at the point of Muhammad's death.
632 AD, all the way, and it, you know, there is some demarcation. There are three times in modern history where Islam unites. They unite during the Crusades. They unite during the first 100 years after Muhammad's death, when Ali actually becomes the caliph. He's the fourth caliph. And then they united in 1998 under Osama bin Mohammed bin Laden. And so we are seeing right in front of us right now the third unification of Islam.
And that unification, how would you characterize that? I mean, obviously, the differences in teachings and practices persist. What is it that unifies them now?
Well, what unifies them is a common enemy. You know, if you think of it this way, Christians have, in the past, we unite under a common umbrella, for instance, pro-life. It seems to cut across denominational lines. Well, in Islam, the Ummah, the Brotherhood, unites under certain issues, and one of them is a common enemy, which, of course, America, they consider the great shaitan, the great iblis, the great devil.
So why, if united against us, or the West, or the United States, why are they fighting against each other in places like Iraq?
Brilliant question. Because their denominational differences go back 1,300 years, whereas in our world, we consider each other brothers and sisters. For instance, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist, etc. We consider each other brothers and sisters in Christ. We may have different polity, different ways we carry out liturgy, but we're still brothers and sisters in Christ. There is no such in Islam. Sunni do not believe that Shiite are going to paradise. Shiite do not believe Sunni are correct. And so they consider one another a cult, even though they may have a tenuous, if you will, unification under one basic issue. Their fight is still their fight. That's why when he was still alive, when Saddam Hussein would bomb a Shiite mosque, it was permissible because he was Sunni. And so no Sunni would speak out against this. The Shia would, of course. And, of course, if you've ever seen the news when a Shia will cut himself, this is a celebration, if you will, a commemoration of the murder of Muhammad's grandson. And Shia are saying that we will, you know, we would defend until the shedding of our own blood the grandson of Muhammad. Well, the irony there is that the shedding of that blood was done by Sunni Muslims.
What school of Islam does Osama bin Laden espouse?
He's a Wahhabi. A Wahhabi is a subsect of probably the most orthodox group of Sunni Muslims. And you will often hear him when he speaks, you will hear him say, you know, I'm saying this to the Muslims. You know this to be the truth. And he quotes from the Quran. They are doctrinaire. They are absolute, if I could use this phrase without it being too, you know, problematic, they are the fundamentalist of Islam because they are absolutely orthodox. They believe you must live as Muhammad lived 1,300 years ago. The dress code, the eating, you know, they're almost Luddite. If you understand that reference, you know, they have a very strong anti-modernity stance, compound mentality. And the Wahhabi are strongest in Saudi Arabia. They are also in a couple of other places, but in Saudi Arabia, they absolutely hold sway. They are the voice in politics.
Why was it so important, going back to the historical roots of the first big division between Shia and Sunni, why was it so important after Muhammad's death that someone take his place?
If you understand the context of Islam, everything Muhammad did, he did to counteract Catholicism, Greek Orthodoxy. You know, Islam did not rise as a misunderstanding of Christianity. Islam is a repudiation of Christianity. They absolutely repudiate the central and core doctrines of Scripture. And so every now and again I'll have somebody say, well, you know, why can't we all just get along? We're all the same. Absolutely. There's no Muslim on the planet who would say this. It's only in the Christian context when somebody would make this kind of a statement. the Muslims were looking for their own Vatican, Mecca being Vatican. You have to have a pope. You cannot have another prophet, because Muhammad said he is the final seal of the prophets. He's the final prophet. So there has to be a voice, a caliph, if you will. At the time of his death, they have multiple versions of the Quran. It is one of the caliphs who burns 24 out of the 25 versions and basically gives them their quote-unquote inerrant Arabic text. And he unites all of Islam with sort of a common ethic, a common doctrine. And that's why the hadith is so important. You have the Quran, and then you have the teachings of Muhammad, which are called the hadith. And the caliph is the one who will collate this, who will put this together so that any country that calls itself an Islamic republic has one constitution, one bill of rights.
Is there a caliph today?
No, that's the beauty of history. And what is so shocking to me when Americans cry, well, we need to be out of Iraq. You know, we were in Germany until 52. We were in Japan for much past the World War II. We can't simply just walk away and expect democracy to hold sway. It's not going to happen. We have very short-term memory in our culture. And those that would then say, well, we shouldn't have been in it in the first place, they don't even get our recent history. The reason we were there now is because we did not finish the job in 1990. Islam, to say that Islam will coexist peacefully if we just leave them alone is naive at best. It is a tragic misunderstanding at worst. But after World War II, Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, dissolves, and the caliphate is gone. The very first time that Osama bin Laden speaks, that we have that we actually have his text, after the signing of the fatwa in February of 1998, he says, for the last 80 years, there has not been a common voice. He's referencing the fall of the caliphate in 1917, 1919.
When we come back from this break, if there isn't an official caliphate in Islam today, is there an unofficial, a de facto caliphate? Dr. Ergun Kaner will answer that question after this. Here's your chance to win a $100 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House. Email 10 friends the latest Issues Etc. YouTube video, and we'll register you to win a gift certificate from Concordia Publishing House. We'll announce the winner on August 28th. Just go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, copy and paste the video's embed code into an email, send it to 10 friends, relatives, or fellow parishioners. Be sure to send a carbon of your email with your name and address to talkback@issuesetc.org. Tell 10 friends about Issues Etc. and tune in on Friday, August the 28th to find out if you're the winner of a $100 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House. Go to issuesetc.org, click promote, and send the Issues Etc. YouTube video to your friends.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Texas Pregnancy Care Network receives high honors.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Texas Pregnancy Care Network is a nonprofit charitable organization committed to helping women facing unplanned pregnancies. Since 2006, the network has served over 21,000 Texas women who made over 100,000 visits. Like most nonprofits, the network strives to earn and keep the trust of the families it helps and those who donate to its work. Recently, the Standards for Excellence Institute awarded the Texas Pregnancy Care Network its highest rating, the prestigious Seal of Excellence. It is the first nonprofit organization in Texas to earn this high distinction.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the denominations of Islam with Dr. Ergun Kaner, a former Sunni Muslim and president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary and graduate school in Lynchburg, Virginia. Dr. Kaner, before the break, You mentioned that there is no official caliphate. There hasn't been one in Islam, a leadership of that kind, for about 100 years. Is there an unofficial, a de facto caliphate in Islam today?
No, there are men that have followers, men who are considered wise leaders, and they often conflict with one another. They don't get along. They don't have commonality. What you have is basically them calling, you know, say, followers of another leader heretics, and those that are calling the first leader truth are called heretics by the others. It is an ongoing battle that I think we will not see the end of for a while. I really think that this will continue for a while, because I think the ultimate goal will be a caliphate. I think a reestablishment of the caliphate is part of the oil barons' desire, because they keep speaking of this. They keep speaking of a spiritual center, and I think what they're aiming toward is exactly that.
What will that mean, a reestablishment of the caliphate?
A world voice with whom we have to negotiate every time, a superpower who has unlimited resources, unlimited followers as long as they are Sunni. You know, everything depends on who this caliph is. If he represents both Sunni and Shia, which I doubt will happen, then somewhere in the vicinity of 450 to 500 million other Muslims will unite. But at worst, at the least, smallest possibility, 1 billion Muslims will have their own pope.
How likely do you think that is, Dr. Kaner?
It'll happen in our lifetime. It will happen. It will happen in the next two generations. It takes time. It takes a second generation of leaders who are a little less strident than the ones who are presently in there. They will again unite under a common enemy, against a common enemy, and they will probably play the martyr card. You know, we are the whole world is against us. We need a common voice. I think it will happen in your lifetime and mine.
Do you think? I guess to kind of stray into a question that's geopolitical for a moment. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the leaders in the West understand what you mentioned before, this being the third great unification, a practical unification of Islam, and an imminent reestablishment of the caliphate? Do you think they understand that?
No, absolutely not. The political leaders who did understand this have fallen off the world stage. The former president understood this. The current president not only doesn't understand it, but he is woefully inadequate in his world geopolitical position. I think you are seeing Sarkozy in France as really the only last surviving voice who understands the history of Islam and who is willing to take a stand against it. We're seeing Britain overrun. Even here in America, in Dearborn, Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan, it is called Little Riyadh. They are doing what my people always do. We move into an area, we live in pockets, we claim religious freedom when we are in the minority, we take away religious freedom when we are in the majority, we ask for Sharia law. It's as old as history, modern history, but nobody, if they do pay attention, I think they have utopian ideals. They think, well, if we just sit at the table and negotiate, but Islam was never bent on negotiation. Islam was bent on domination.
How is Sunni Islam different from its much smaller cousin, Shia?
Well, a number of celebrations are different. For instance, Alawite, which is in the Middle East very strong, they actually recognize Christmas and Easter. A lot of it has to do with toleration and minority status. Shia Islam can become more strident, like Ayatollah Khomeini, but we have seen in recent history that Sunni Islam can equally be legalistic and orthodox in its stance as well. And so I don't think there's any real difference in ethic. What they have is a difference in eschatology. Shia Islam is extremely eschatological. They are doing what they do. You see Ahmadinejad say, you know, we are waiting for Mahdi, and they have the al-Mahdi army. Al-Mahdi is a messianic figure in Islam who is, he's not Messiah in terms of atonement, but he is coming. He will fight against al-Dajjal. He will fight against the Antichrist. He will take a stand in the last days. And so for Shia, it's very prophetic. Sunni is more bent on domination than it is prophecy.
Is there a branch of Islam that advocates terrorism more than others?
That's an interesting question, Tony. That's fascinating. I've never thought of it in that terms. I think Wahhabi would probably be the easy answer, but the more thorough answer is all of them. You know, all of them, if they are orthodox, if they are conservative, understand exactly what jihad is. I think what we're seeing is maybe an easier question would be, is there any branch that is attempting to move away from orthodox Islam? And they are the modern Muslims, the westernized Muslims, continental European Muslims. And basically it's because they are torn between two worlds. They are torn between the democracy they enjoy and they are torn between the Islam that they follow.
Someone might suggest that another sect of Islam is on the rise, precisely that group that you just mentioned, westernized Islam, that by hook or crook will either now or in time comprise a moderate form of Islam, still holding nominally to the beliefs and practices of traditional Islam, but then influenced by Western sensibilities, in effect is kind of an Islam we can deal with. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've also heard it referred to by one of the former president's advisors as Islam light, that they are willing to take some of the major doctrines of personal piety, but politically they are disengaged. I doubt if they will ever rise to any type of real leadership. We've seen a couple of books, bestsellers, that have been written by Muslims saying we have to get away from this. We have to become more and more adaptable. The problem is, every time a Muslim stands up and speaks and says we need peace, the obvious and first question should be, great, peace with whom? Do you mean Israel? Because what they're asking for is they're asking for us to recognize their right to exist, but they will never recognize Israel's right to exist, which should be the bottom line for any kind of negotiation. It should be our first point. It should be before we even walk to the table. Do you recognize Israel's right to exist? The problem is any Muslim who does this becomes endangered by other Muslims, not by Jews, not by Christians, but Sadat, Anwar Sadat in Egypt. In Pakistan, we've seen this. Any voice of moderation immediately becomes a target for the more orthodox Muslims. Until that changes, I don't know if there'll be any kind of substantial change in Islam.
What school of Islam do most American or Western Muslims espouse?
Hanabi. The major form, Hanabi, is they are the ones who controlled Mecca. They are the largest theological school. They do most of the training for the imams who come to America, the training that takes place overseas in places like my city, Istanbul. You will always see differences in the small groups, even within that. It's like saying the word Baptist. You know, there are 63 different types of Baptist. There are 14 different types of Lutheran. I believe 11 major sects of Presbyterian. The same thing. Even though the school of Sunni Islam may be the majority form, there are still divisions within.
So if you were to walk into, say you were in Dearborn or Ann Arbor, one of those nucleuses of Islam in the United States, if you were to walk into one of the Islamic schools where the children are taught.
Yeah, madrasa, yes.
What brand of Islam are they being schooled in?
They will usually do like our schools do here. Any kind of Christian school that you see in America will often have kids from various denominations. It's rare that you will have everyone in one denomination. They stick to the major points. The madrasas stick to the major points. The difference, however, is we are now in our present context seeing Islam bifurcate even on the Western field. Heretofore, mosques were basically mosques, with the exception of the Nation of Islam, which is an American subgroup. With the exception of the Nation of Islam, a mosque would house everyone, Sunni and Shia. But we are now seeing in major cities a variety of mosques spreading in one city, and that's because they're splitting. Like churches, you know, how like churches split when there's a fight. There's splits over teaching, splits over who's going to be the imam, splits over how they practice, and so they start another mosque in the same city. This is really the first time in American history we've seen this.
So there was kind of a generic Islam, yes, up until recently.
Well, it was by survival. It's what they do in any country. You will have a major mosque again, mimicking Catholicism. Every city in the world has a cathedral. That's where the bishop sits. And then smaller Catholic churches, you know, spread all around that cathedral. Well, in Islam, you would basically have one mosque, and everyone would go to that mosque. They may study in different places. They may have a foundation in a different place, but they would come to that one mosque. We are now seeing that these various mosques are rising up in contradistinction one to another. They're contradicting one another.
Now, that's intriguing. So it raises this question. We'll get to it on the other side of the break. Past and present, has Islam mirrored the Roman Catholic model in the way that it kind of wants to spread itself out? Dr. Ergun Kaner will answer that question for us on the other side of the break. 10 more minutes with him on the various denominations of Islam. He's a former Sunni Muslim, president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary and Graduate School in Lynchburg, Virginia, author of several books, including Unveiling Islam, An Insider's Look at Muslim Beliefs and Practices. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, August the 17th. We'll be right back.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Click promote and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Would you like to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a regular, monthly, tax-deductible gift? We've made it easy for you to donate using automatic withdrawal. Simply fill out and mail the automatic billing authorization form under the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. No more writing monthly checks or making monthly PayPal contributions. issuesetc.org. Click donate and fill out and mail the automatic withdrawal form. Thanks for your support.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Noted author and Christian apologist Craig Hawkins on why you should support Issues Etc.
It's my pleasure to recommend to you Issues Etc. It's one of the few programs discussing crucial concerns for Christians. It's done in a dynamic format, again discussing crucial issues, and in an insightful manner. The program is very much needed. In my opinion, it's one of the most important broadcasts on the air, and it's one of my favorites. So if you want to grow in your faith, know what you believe and why, then this program is for you. I want to encourage you to listen, and I want to encourage you to support the broadcast, both prayerfully and financially.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234, or you can make a credit card donation at our website, issuesetc.org, Defending the Faith, Teaching the Truth, Issues, etc.
Have you ever found yourself in the position where you're telling someone, you know, a coworker, a friend, a family member, something you heard on Issues, etc.? You can articulate what you heard very well, but when they want to know more about the show, it's kind of difficult to describe the unique position that Issues, etc. has in Christian talk radio. Well, we have a promotional video, a YouTube video at our website posted right now. You can send that video. It tells them in a visual way, it's just a little bit more than a minute long, about the guests and the topics and the unique placement that Issues Etc. has in Christian talk radio. You can find it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click promote. The video's right there. Email it to 10 of your friends. And we'll do this. We'll enter your name for a drawing at the end of this month, Friday, August the 28th, on the air, live on the air. We'll draw a name from those who've done this for us, and they'll get a $100 gift certificate to Concordia Publishing House. issuesetc.org. Click promote and send that video to 10 of your friends. Thank you very much. Dr. Ergun Kaner is our guest for the next 10 minutes. We're talking about the various denominations of Islam. Before the break, you talked about how they how they mimic Catholicism in the building of cathedrals and whatnot. Is this a conscious effort? And are there other ways that they mimic Catholicism?
You can't underestimate and you can't overstate Muhammad's hatred of Catholicism. It paralleled his hatred for the Jew. And a lot of what Islam does is just a monkeying of Catholicism. For instance, Catholics have Lent, Muslims have Ramadan. Catholics have the rosary, and in Islam we have masala, which are the beads. You count the 99 names of Allah. It looks exactly like a rosary. The dress codes, the outfits. There's so much that is similar. You can't underestimate or overstate it.
What makes Sufi or Sufism different from Shia and Sunni?
Well, I got to tell you, these are some great questions. These are questions I usually get in graduate class. This is wonderful. Sufi Islam is a Turkish or Asiatic form of Islam, and I don't want to say that they mixed Hindu concepts. But what they did was they took some Hindu practices. The idea in Sufi Islam is that you can come into union with Allah. So, you know, unlike Hindus, they believe that there's an actual monotheistic God, but they believe that the individual practitioner can find, if it's fair to say this term, nirvana by coming into union with Allah. Well, the whirling dervish, the spinning, this is Sufi. This is very strong in my country, in Turkey. But the second form, I think most of your listeners would be aware of, is the use of psychotropic drugs in Sufi Islam, the shisha, the hashish pipe, the use of poppy, the use of, you know, these drugs that they believed loosened your mind so that you could become united with with Allah. This is, of course, strongly discouraged in Sunni Islam, but in Sufi Islam, it's actually part and practice.
It's a mystical form of Islam?
Very mystical, very monistic. You know, the idea of Allah being in everything and everything is in Allah, and if you simply lose your mind, you come into union with Allah, that it is possible to have an intimacy with Allah. This is, of course, shirk. This is the highest sin in Islam, but to say that you come into union with Allah, that's Sufi Islam. And again, I take questions and answers sometimes on my website and on Twitter, and these Muslims will scream, you know, how can you say this? And I'll go, it's Sufi Islam. And they will say, well, those are not true Muslims. And I'll go, but they are a viable form of Islam.
So what teachings can be found in all the schools of Islam, whatever they may be? What are the lowest common denominator teachings that you would find in all these schools?
That Allah is Tawheed. That is, He is wholly one, separate. He is not intimate. You do not have a personal relationship with Allah. That Allah is separate from man. He is judge and creator. That's what Tawheed means. That Muhammad is the final prophet, although there are entire denominations based on follow-up prophets, like Baha'u'llah and the Baha'i, that Muhammad brought a message that corrected Christianity, that the Quran is the supreme book, the final text. After that, everything becomes divided.
You said that you expected not only this unification that's underway, but also a reestablishment of the caliphate. Within our lifetimes, we're probably about the same age. So we're talking, let's say, 50 years from now. Mm-hmm. If you were going to prognosticate about what Islam is in the world, the state of Islam in the world 50 or 60 years from now, how would you describe it, your best guess?
Well, you have to see it in light of the rest of the world, how the world community goes. If our world community does what it normally does, right now we are in a pacifist swing. I see history as a pendulum. I teach it to my students. We swing back and forth from protectionist and isolationist to spreading democracy, back to a very conservative stance, to a liberal stance. We will have a classic correction. You know, and what we are seeing right now, I don't get too upset about, because eventually America will wake up and swing back. If we take the stand like Sarkozy, like Margaret Thatcher, like Ronald Reagan, and, you know, Islam is a viable threat, and we have to deal with it. I think what you'll see is the caliphate uniting sooner rather than later. I think Muslims will use that to try to unify. If, however, we try to maintain diplomacy, and by diplomacy I mean, you know, capitulation, they will take countries. And as they take those countries, they will make those countries the base of a caliphate. It will be much stronger, but it may take longer for it to emerge.
Finally, then, is Islam in any way theologically compatible with historic Christianity?
Oh, absolutely not. No Muslim would think so, and only naive and misinformed Christians would. Islam does not desire to unite with Christianity. Islam desires to overtake Christianity. And anything less than that is considered a compromise on their part. It is, well, the best term I can use, it is naive for Christians to say, oh, well, you know, we have so much in common. Karen Armstrong, the author, makes this tragic mistake constantly in her writings, that she tries to find commonality. You know, well, they're both monotheistic. Well, so is Molech. You know, so is Baal, for that matter. But you don't hear anybody, you don't see Elijah saying, well, you know, Baal, the prophets of Baal, why don't we just get together and have a dinner? In 1 Kings 17, he pretty much makes it clear that there's only one God, Jehovah, creator God of the universe, and that you can't modify his name or nature. Just by taking his name doesn't mean that you're teaching about the same God.
Folks, you'll find a link to Dr. Ergun Kaner's website and to his book, Unveiling Islam, under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Ergun Kaner is a former Sunni Muslim. He's president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary and Graduate School in Lynchburg, Virginia, and author of several books, including Unveiling Islam, An Insider's Look at Muslim Beliefs and Practices. Dr. Kaner, thank you very much.
Anytime, my brother.
Folks, help us defend the faith and teach the truth by making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Here's the address one more time, LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thank you in advance for your support of Issues Etc. Some would say that when Muhammad founded this religion, whether he was receiving his revelations from the devil or making them up himself, who knows? It really doesn't matter anymore. When he founded this religion, Islam, he was doing it consciously as a reaction to Christianity, whether he understood it well or not. I think that's true. Islam exists, some even would assert, as an extremely perverse heresy of Christianity. I don't know if that's true. It's hard to classify it. But what it does teach us, the history, the divisions, the differences from Muslim to Muslim in Islam, is that we as Christians need to understand this religion. We cannot caricature it, because then we're not dealing with Islam as it is. If we want Muslims to deal with Christianity as it is, not as they suppose it to be, then we need to return the favor. We need to deal with Islam as it is. That means understanding the subtle differences, the big differences, but especially understanding this. The difference between Islam and Christianity, not the rhetoric of what the Muslim may say about the infidel. Lay that aside and understand the real, basic, and objective difference between Christianity and Islam. It is found there in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. The Muslim will great homage to Jesus as prophet, as predecessor to Muhammad, but not the Jesus of Holy Scripture, not the Jesus who came to reveal God the Father, his Father, to us, and there, by his perfect life, death, and resurrection, make us sons and daughters of that same God and Father as well. That's the big difference between Christianity and Islam. Jesus, our Savior. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.